Dr. Sean Williams was a familiar face and voice on BBC Breakfast, Television News and Radio 4 for many years, and she's now a presenter on Radio 3 Unwind on BBC Sounds. There she hosts a three-hour programme every morning, sharing a restorative selection of music with the aim of supporting your well-being. She also presents Life Changing on Radio 4, interviewing people who have lived through extraordinary events. In 2012, she started to train as a psychologist and was awarded a doctorate in counselling psychology 4 years ago. Since then, she's been working in the NHS, primarily with first responders who are experiencing anxiety, stress and trauma. Sean, you've brought us a rich mix of music, Mozart, Rachmaninoff, Max Richter, but I think we're going to start with Vivaldi.
Yes, Vivaldi's Spring. And actually, this is a version that I found quite late. I've always loved the Four Seasons, but Adrian Chandler's version, which sounds so fresh. You know when you've been listening to something for a long time and then you listen to a performer and think, oh, and it awakens you, doesn't it? And this is what Spring does for me. It is so vibrant and colourful and joyful, and it's like popping candy and adrenaline and caffeine all rolled into one.
Isn't that lovely?
Yes, and there's a sudden moment when we both looked at each other, when the harmony changes.
Yes.
I could see you were energised by the way it was slowing down and then lifting up again.
Yeah, I think that's what I really like about this version, is that sometimes it holds back, or you feel it's holding back, and then it sprints forward a little and then holds back a bit, and I really enjoy the interpretation.
The Allegro, the first movement of spring from Vivaldi's Four Seasons, performed by Adrian Chandler and La Serenissima. Sean Williams, tell me a little bit about your childhood. Perhaps surprisingly, given your name, you grew up in East Sussex.
Oh, I know. Just letting the whole of the Welsh nation down with my very Welsh name. I'm actually born in Paddington in London. My mum was a nurse and training at St Mary's Hospital in Paddington. My dad was a journalist, both of them Welsh. In fact, the Welsh heritage goes back more than 300 years. So I was the very first to be born outside Wales, to be born on the other side of the border in St Mary's Paddington, which was her hospital. And she used to say to me that Paddington is the fastest way home because it's on the rail line.
Great Western.
Yeah, exactly. Welshness sort of thrums in my DNA. And I know I have no birthright in terms of where I was born, but I think just from the people I've been surrounded with, the values that they've given me. We spent so much time in Wales as well because, of course, all my parents' family were still there.
Is there a particular area you go back to?
Well, my father's father was from Ruthin in North Wales, but he was born in Swansea. My mum was born in Cardiff, so typically I tend to stick to South Wales.
I think, actually, the next music does remind you of your grandfather.
Yes, it does. Tide, which is grandfather in Welsh, he was a Presbyterian minister. And there are some people where goodness shines out of them. And he was one of those. And I think also because I was young, I was probably 5, 6, 7 when I spent a lot of time with him. He had a manse or a vicarage in Oswestry on the Welsh-English border then. It was a very cold house. There was only one fire in the back room. And in the front room, pride of place, was a baby grand piano. Now, this was a simple man with simple tastes, living as a Presbyterian minister in a very cold house. And he had this amazing piano. And I used to sit with him while he played. Moonlight Sonata was one of them. It was the first movement that I remember him trying to teach me. And I can put myself back there now, sitting on that piano stool next to him. The slight scratchiness of the tweed, the smell of his pipe smoke, his patience and love.
And I think it's the presto you've chosen, presto agitato.
It is, because I know that if I listened to the first movement, it would probably make me cry. And I'm quite an emotional person at the best of times. And I love this because of its sort of passion and vitality. And Radulupu plays it in such an exciting way. And I was with my uncle at the weekend, Tide's son, my dad's brother. And we listened to Moonlight Sonata from the beginning to the end together. And he was in tears. And he said, that's the way he played it.
Thank you. It's a gallop at times, isn't it?
It really does. It really gallops, yes.
Presto agitato, the third movement from the Moonlight Sonata by Beethoven, wonderfully performed by Radu Lupu. I think, Sean Williams, that you spent quite a bit of time near the sea in Eastbourne during your childhood.
I did. That's where I spent most of my childhood, actually. And that was a great place to grow up for a kid. I've got two younger brothers.
Twin brothers.
I know, I cannot call them the twins. They will go mad if they're listening to this, because that was the one thing that I knew would wind them up. I was an older sister, an annoying older sister, 3 years older. And I used to say, twins, twins, time for lunch. And it drove them bonkers. But Eastbourne was a great place to grow up. You've got the sea, you've got a playground on your doorstep for the whole year. It can reflect your emotions back to you, the sea, I think. And if you go down there and you're in a particular mood, then it can suck all that away from you. It's an amazing place. I loved it.
With both parents working, it must have needed to be quite a tightly run ship at home.
Yes, and we were made to be and feel very independent. I mean, as long as we were there for supper. My father was, as I say, a journalist and absolutely fanatical about the time. We would always have to be there at 6 o'clock when supper was ready, on the pips of Radio 4 and when the oven door was opening. So, yes, it was tightly controlled in that regard. But because they were both working nights, Mum was an intensive care nurse. You know, Dad was working nights, and sometimes we had to creep around during the day because one or other would be sleeping. But we had a lot of independence, all of us. So we all had bikes and we all cycled around.
Good training not to crash the pips then, even in those early days.
Although, Michael, the first time I presented a Radio 4 show, I was doing Saturday Live. I crashed them on the first time.
How did you get on at school?
You know what? School wasn't a great time for me. I found school quite difficult. I was at a grammar school, so I'd made it through the 11 plus, even though nobody told you you were doing an 11 plus. It just happened on the day. And then I found myself having been, I thought, quite good in my primary school to being very average in this grammar school. And more than that, I didn't really feel like I'd found a place. My father was fearsomely intelligent, as is my uncle and my family. My brothers were too. I didn't have what they had. I don't know what it was, the ability to hold knowledge. Perhaps they had more rigour in their learning. I don't know. But I didn't feel I had that. And I really remember a school report which said, Sian Williams is a small girl with thin powers of concentration, who tries hard and is keen to please. I mean, it's cutting, but it was probably quite accurate then, and it's probably quite accurate now, in truth.
Well, you were perhaps a late developer in some ways, and after all, these qualities come out at different times in life, don't they? I worry sometimes that we pigeonhole people. I was a late developer too, but we find our way in due course.
Yes, and it gave me huge confidence when I did a master's in psychology, and it was a science master's, so I had to do statistics. And I was thinking, I can't get through statistics. I didn't even have a maths O level. I didn't even have a maths CSE. How I managed to get into any institution, I don't know. And I got through it, and I got a distinction for my master's. And I was so proud of myself at that moment. I thought, don't let whatever anybody says about you define you in those early years, because that's their judgment. That shouldn't necessarily be your judgment.
You actually studied English and history at university. What made you want to choose those subjects, bearing in mind you went in a different direction later?
Well, I wanted to be a journalist. I was very excited by my dad's job. Every time the phone rang, it would take him somewhere. We always had the news on in the house. We had all the newspapers. We talked about what was going on. My dad said, don't be a journalist, and whatever you do, don't join the BBC. So I did both. And I thought English and history would be a good foundation, but I was told that I wouldn't really get into university because I didn't have the academic credentials. I went to what was then a polytechnic, which is now Oxford Brookes University, applied to a print journalism course afterwards and the BBC, and got lucky enough to get both, and chose the BBC.
Now, Rachmaninoff, the third piano concerto. Why?
It feels like it's a box of different tastes of chocolates. If that's the right metaphor, it might not be. It has romanticism and lyricism. It starts with a lovely melody and it ends with a lovely melody. But in the middle, it goes everywhere. Is this passion? Is this rage? Where has this come from? But I love that. I love the fact that music can take you to so many different places. And then you have almost a resolve at the end when the melody comes back, as if it's saying, everything's going to be okay. Here we are again.
Well, of course, Rachmaninoff did go through quite bad sort of mental depressions,
yes,
and things, which must interest you. And I think people that have actually experienced that and put it into music do us all a favour, because there's a cathartic element of listening to it. We can identify with it.
There is an echoing back. Sometimes in therapy, words can't do justice to feelings. And I think at that time, you've got to find other ways. Hearing a piece of music where you can identify with that feeling, it takes you somewhere, it shows it back to you, it holds you at the same time, is incredibly important. And yes, this piece does just that.
Thank you.
so beautiful. It's so bonkers and brilliant. And that was Lang Lang's version, 2001, from the Proms, and I was really lucky enough to be there. I remember, bear in mind, this lad was 19, so young, and to attempt something like this with such complexity, when Rachmaninoff wrote it for a US tour, didn't he? And he was dreading the tour. And then he composed something which was so difficult for anyone else to play. He could play it, but other pianists didn't play it for years and years afterwards because it was such a huge thing. And Lang Lang, 19, there he was, eyes closed, as I remember, completely immersed in it. And it was such a joy to watch him. And when he finished, the whole place erupted in applause at the Royal Albert Hall. It was really special.
We heard the opening movement, Allegro Man on Tanto, which is allegro but not too fast, not an express train, as it were, from Rachmaninoff's Piano Concerto No. 3 in D minor, performed by Lang Lang and the St. Petersburg Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Yuri Temirkanov. Sean, you actually studied journalism in America, didn't you?
Well, let's use some heavy inverted commas. I was lucky. I won a scholarship to go to Rhode Island University and study critical journalistic writing. If I tell you that my thesis was on the history of Cosmopolitan from its birth to today, that might give you an idea of the sorts of things I was doing there. It was great fun. I'd never lived abroad before, and to be so independent. And America was so exciting. One thing I did do is my first news reading, I was on RI 104. And because I was the English voice, I hammed it up a little bit, Michael, in truth. Hello and welcome to RI 104. It was my first introduction to news reading.
You were outrageous, in other words.
Well, they bought it.
You came back to the UK and spent 5 years at BBC Radio Merseyside as a reporter and producer. And that meant that you were covering stories like Hillsborough.
Yes, it was a terrible football stadium disaster. I think it was the first ever time that a radio station went 24 hours. It was unfolding before us without any of us realising what was going on. And that chaos. I was a really young rookie reporter and sent out to a pub where all the Liverpool supporters were dropped off to come back into Liverpool from the Sheffield Wednesday ground. And they were so confused. They didn't know what had happened. Some of them had left their loved ones behind. And I was talking to them as somebody who was, what would I have been then, 21? No understanding of grief, no understanding of shock, no understanding of trauma, with a microphone thinking, I hope I'm doing this justice. I hope I'm doing these people justice, you know? That's a big old thing. That stayed with me. I can hear it. That has stayed with me. That importance of paying respect to the people that you're talking to in what is often their worst ever day.
And to do that, you have to sometimes bury your immediate emotions yourself, because as we've just heard in your voice, these things affect one profoundly. But you've got to somehow deliver uncompromised reporting, as it were.
Because it's not about you. Mm. You're just the vehicle through which the story is told. And you always have to hold on to that.
And how did the move from producer to presenter come about? Was it a natural step?
No. Not at all. I didn't want to be a presenter. I liked being behind the scenes. I'm actually quite shy, which is ridiculous for somebody who spent most of their life on screen or behind a microphone. I was on News 24 as a editor, so I was helping put together programmes. I was helping out with some screen tests, and one of the would-be presenters fell ill. And they said, well, Sean, we've booked the studio, we've booked the camera people, we've got the lights, we've got the director. Can you just sit there and pretend to be a presenter? You know, they took away my auto cue and they were throwing interviews at me. And I had very short hair and I was wearing a man's jacket. And I could not have been further from a BBC News presenter. And it was fun. I just thought, this is a laugh. I'm never going to do this again.
So you relaxed, in fact, as one often does when one thinks it doesn't matter.
Yes. Well, it didn't matter because I was going back to my job in production, effectively. And then they asked me whether I'd like to present the 4 till 7 slot on this new channel? And I said, no, thanks very much. So there was a bit of persuading.
Maybe you were thinking of saying, spare me, O Lord.
Maybe I was.
Which is a
link.
Terrible segue.
I like the way you do that, Michael. Spare me, O Lord, for my days are as nothing by Cristobal de Morales, which is a Gregorian chant, so it's ancient.
Performed by Jan Garbarek and the Hilliard Ensemble. It's a very interesting coming together of saxophone and early music exponents.
When I was in Liverpool, I listened a lot to jazz because I was going out with a bass guitarist. He introduced me to lots of really beautiful music. He asked me, when we split up years and years later, have you got my cassettes? And I said, oh, no, sorry, I don't have them. And then I found them. Decades on, I found them. So I've still got Dave Davis's cassettes, if you're listening. This is a gorgeous, gorgeous piece because it takes the ancient. And when you listen to the saxophone, it just glides over it. It's not too intrusive. It is a beautiful way of reinterpreting a very, very old chant.
Thank you.
Doesn't that make you want to take just a deep breath? It's so clever of Jan Gabarek to take something that was written in the 16th century and to say, I'm going to do something with this, but I won't intrude.
And the saxophone sort of extends what the voices can do. It sort of takes off and goes into another register.
Yes, it absolutely does.
We heard Pace Mihai Domine, Spare Me, O Lord, For My Days Are As Nothing, performed by Jan Gabarek and the Hilliard Ensemble. You're listening to Private Passions, where my guest today is the journalist, presenter and psychologist, Dr. Sian Williams. So you became a special correspondent for BBC News at 6. Mm. What kind of big stories did you cover there?
I was sent all over the place, wherever the story was. I was on the 6 o'clock news and I was doing BBC Breakfast when I first started BBC Breakfast. And I was sent to the Asian tsunami, where hundreds of thousands of people died. And I went to Sri Lanka and I was in Gaul. That was a thriving community which had been swept away. And I remember standing there on a beach looking down at a handbag that had been left. A woman had been taken from it, wrenched by the sea, and her handbag was still there and it was open and all the contents were spilled out onto the beach. And I was doing the broadcast, and that to me was, that's why you're here. You're here to tell the stories of those who can't tell their stories.
And that must be very hard to deal with as a reporter.
I think you learn to create, because you have to, a distance between you and what's happening. And it's only when you get home. And sometimes even when you get home, you can't say what you've seen. It feels too much. And it feels disrespectful in a way. I learned subsequently, actually, about the importance of talking and the importance of reflecting. And I looked around me at other colleagues who'd been on other stories and thought, gosh, all of us are probably walking around holding stuff. And sadly, even the biggest disaster will start, as we say, falling down the running order. And you'll be on something else. You'll be sent somewhere else. So you've got to deal with it. And I think a lot of journalists, what they tend to do is to say, I'll manage that later when I've got time to sort that out and it feels safe to sort that out. And truth is, a lot of them don't have that time and space to do that.
What is the brain doing when it experiences things like that? Does it automatically compartmentalise? What did your research show you?
Well, it's different things for different people. So you know about fight, flight, freeze, and there's also submit, there's tend and befriend. But because there's a bit of our brain called the amygdala, which is looking out for the threat and the danger, it can be on like an alarm all the time. Yeah. That prevents other bits of our brain from working properly. Memories can be stored in the wrong place, which is why memory of a horrible event can be really fractured and difficult and take time for a therapist to put together. And you can always be on high alert. That's what the brain does in order to protect you for the next threat that might be coming. But it's not always helpful.
Wasn't the experience of skydivers helpful in understanding how the brain processes danger?
I did some research which picked up on a study that somebody had done with skydivers and cortisol. Our stress response is called cortisol, the hormone. What happened with the skydivers is even the experienced skydivers who'd jumped out of planes multiple times had a similar level of cortisol or stress response to the novice skydivers. So those who jumped out of the plane for the very first time. And what that told me is you can get used to the level of stress that you're in and not even recognise it, not even feel it. The experienced skydivers were like, yeah, this is nothing. You know, we've done this time and time again. Yet their levels are very similar.
And there's something called post-traumatic growth, isn't there?
Yeah. How to recover well after something difficult. There's a psychologist called Carl Rogers who talked about something called the self-actualizing theory. What this is about is people's capacity to grow after something difficult. We are always reaching towards the light. He saw potatoes in his parents' basement and the tubers were growing towards the light. And he thought that is what humans do. Whatever happens, however dark it is, we try to grow towards the light. But it's not easy. It's tough stuff.
And have you become a passionate skydiver yourself?
No, I've been asked to jump out of a plane for a charity, and I did say to my husband, I'm going to jump out of a plane. He said, you've got five children, you're staying at home. So I didn't do it.
The Cora. I'm dying to talk about and explore the Cora. Tell me about this.
So the Cora is a West African instrument and used often, actually, in storytelling. I wonder whether this is why I'm drawn to its sound. And combined with a harp that is used in Welsh storytelling.
Of course.
And bringing together Wales and West Africa, you know, Senegal and Swansea, creates a lovely, lovely sound. But there's a generosity as well, isn't there, in the playing, that back and forth.
It becomes a conversation,
yes. And I particularly like a piece by Catherine Finch, who used to be the king's harpist. Anseku Keita is on the Cora, and they come together for Cephalai. My Welsh is not what it was, but this is Horses. Thank you. you can just imagine stories being told as the kora and the harp are played, can't you? In the Bardic tradition of Wales and in the West African tradition with the kora. And Catherine, I mean, what a talent she is. She was playing harp when she was about six and she got her first harp at 10, but her parents had to remortgage their house for it. That's a big old commitment, isn't it? And Catherine went through breast cancer in her 30s. And I think her music shows an expressiveness. So it was hard for her to play the harp for a while because of the treatment. And to go back to it must have been such a joy for her.
Kefala, or Horses, by Catherine Finch and Sekou Keita playing the kora from their album Dibbon Bells. In 2016, Sean Williams, you too underwent your own personal trauma, didn't you?
Yes. So I was diagnosed with breast cancer, luckily a very treatable breast cancer. I was told quite that I would have to have a double mastectomy quite quickly. And it came as a real shock. I'm sure it does to everyone. Gosh, there'll be people listening to this saying, yeah, well, Sian, it came as a shock to me too. You can feel like you're doing all the right things, that you're looking after yourself, you're healthy, you're eating well, you haven't got too much stress in your life, bloody, bloody, blah. And then, bang, you've got cancer and you've got to deal with it. And suddenly life goes on a different path for a while. And I said to the oncologist, I don't understand why I have this. And he said, genetics and bad luck, Sian, it's just the same as everybody else. Sometimes there is no reason. You're desperately trying to search for the facts, as I was, I guess, as a journalist. And I approached it very much as a journalist. So when I was sitting in the room where they first told me, I was writing everything down in my little notebook and said, and what time's the interview? And she said, no, Sian, we're talking about surgery. And I thought, oh, I've been trying to do what I do with everything else in my life, which is this can be at a bit of a distance. And of course, it's not. It absolutely affected everyone in our family. I was incredibly lucky, as I say. I had treatment, very good treatment with the NHS, and they have looked after me subsequently very well. I was back there just last week, actually, having a 10-year check, which I didn't really need because after five, they said to me, you're just as likely to get a recurrence of breast cancer as anyone is likely to get it for the first time. But I can't thank them enough because it can be the most terrifying experience, not just for you, but for the people around you who can't help in the way that they'd like.
You initially dealt with it very privately, didn't you?
Yes, because I didn't want it, this might sound odd, I didn't want it to be about me. For me, it was about making sure everybody else was okay. And I thought, well, there are small children here and older children, adult children. So I've got two boys, a stepdaughter and two younger children. And I didn't want them to be reading about it or hearing about it before we had all had time to process it. So it took a while for us to understand what was going on. One of my sons is a doctor and he almost knew too much. I think that was particularly difficult for him. But they were absolutely brilliant. So it was only when we were in a place where we could look back that I thought, I can probably say something now. Also, I didn't like the narrative that comes with cancer. You know, brave, battle, fighting, survivor. It's fine if other people like that. But me personally thought, well, I lost my mum to cancer. I've lost my dad to cancer. I've lost best friends to cancer. And it's not their fault. I think using battle metaphors makes it seem like something that as long as you fight hard enough, you can win. And we know that's not the case.
You worked on Breakfast News for 11 years alongside Bill Turnbull. It must have been great fun to share the sofa with him, the red sofa.
Oh, it was such good fun to share the sofa with Bill. He was an amazing friend. We'd known each other for 25 years. If you're getting up at 3:30 in the morning, you want to be sitting next to somebody you trust and love and respect. And when I had cancer, he was one of the first people to reach out and say, I know you don't believe, but I do, and I'm praying for you.
B. Bill sadly died himself of cancer, prostate cancer, in 2022, and he was only 66.
Yes, very young.
But incredibly positive up to the end.
Oh, he was just amazing. And, you know, Bill was a private man. And I think to use that experience to raise awareness of prostate cancer, the number of people I've come into contact with who've said, I've gone for a test because of what happened to Bill. He did an enormous amount to raise awareness. And I think that selflessness speaks volumes about the man he was.
And this piece we're going to hear next relates to him.
Yes, it was a piece that was a favourite of his. It's Max Richter, On the Nature of Daylight. And when he told me that he wasn't going to survive this cancer, and I had, it felt so unfair. And I was in Scotland at the time, and I remember listening to On the Nature of Daylight, put my headphones on, and marched up a mountain trying to understand what was going to happen.
Thank you. Max Richter's On the Nature of Daylight. One of the things that's certain in life, Sian, is that we're all going to have to face grief and loss. What do you think are the things that can help us to deal with that and that perhaps helped you?
I think music, definitely. Just hearing that, you know, music can echo grief in a way that nothing else can. I don't think it can echo emotion. That's why sad songs feel so satisfying. It universalises something that feels quite individual. And when there are no words, then music can help in that way. And I remember when my dad was in a hospice and he was dying of cancer, and I was lucky to be with him in those last days. And when he could no longer speak, he wanted to listen to Welsh hymns to take him back to a time and a place that gave him comfort and solace. And he really couldn't say very much, but we would listen to Welsh hymns together. And when he could say a few words, I said, "Why is it that Welsh hymns are so satisfying?" And he looked at me and he went, "Minor chords." and that was it. And Calon Lan, which is a beautiful Welsh hymn, which means pure heart, he loved listening to. And like Bill with Max Richter, which was at his funeral, my dad asked for Calon Lan at his funeral.
Calon Lan, A Pure Heart, performed by Keris Matthews and Fron Male Voice Choir with a wonderful entry.
Oh, it's just so glorious. It's rugby terraces and it's chapel and it's... My dad used to sing in the choir. He did the Messiah every year. And just hearing that, the warmth of those united voices, it just twangs my Welsh DNA. And I think that version with Keris was the one he wanted, because I think Calon Lan, meaning pure heart, it's I don't ask for riches, I don't ask for this, that and the other, but I would like a pure heart, please. Her voice is so pure, and he asked for that version to be played at his funeral.
Sean Williams, you're now working extensively in psychology. Is there a particular area you're focused on?
I work mainly with the emergency services, so people who run towards danger, which is very similar to what a lot of journalists do. So there's a lot of anxiety and stress and symptoms of trauma and trying to find a way that we can live with anxiety. Because if we're going to have it, and we need a certain amount of stress and anxiety to get through the day, to respond when things come up, but if we're on high alert all the time, then that can affect our everyday life. We either zone out and we don't engage with the world, or we're hyper busy and throwing ourselves into things, and that's not good for us either. So at the moment, what I'm researching is how we can live better with our anxiety. Not pushing it away, not fighting it, just saying it's here, what do I do with it now?
Music by a contemporary composer again, Anna Klein.
Yes. This is Dance in the Middle of the Fighting. And it's based on a Rumi poem. And Rumi is an ancient Persian poet, as you know. And to me, it's symbolic of resilience after struggle or within struggle, because, of course, the two can coexist. You can struggle and be resilient. You can be struggling and growing at the same time. And the Rumi poem goes, dance when you're broken open. Dance if you've torn the bandage off. Dance in the middle of the fighting. Dance in your blood. Dance when you're perfectly free.
Thank you.
Dance in the Middle of the Fighting by Anna Klein, performed there by the cellist Inbal Segev and the London Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Marin Alsop. Are you a dancer, Sean Williams?
I wish I was. I did do ballet, but we could only afford one ballet lesson when I was growing up. So it was sort of, there you go. Nope. That'll have to be it.
You have run marathons, though.
I've run marathons, yes.
And being mother of five is a marathon in itself.
Yes, indeed. But very joyous. I've had school-aged children for 35 years of my life.
Wow.
Yeah. So you need to get out. You need to put your trainers on and get
away. You need to unwind. So yes. Tell me how you're finding presenting Classical Unwind, and has it been taking you into other musical realms?
Oh, absolutely. It's one of the best things I've ever done. And I'm really not just saying that, because I've had great times in my career. But I think being asked to do this and to explore different music, because we play 3 hours a day and we're on 7 days a week. I like discovering new pieces and going, listen to this. I mean, there's a team of very good, experienced producers, some of whom are singers and composers, and they bring their influences in and I bring some of mine in, and it's lovely, an absolute joy.
It does make connections, doesn't it?
Yes, and I think it introduces people to music that they might not find elsewhere. Mm. And we bring in a bit of well-being stuff. We've got a great neuropsychologist, Professor Catherine Loveday, who brings in studies about music and the mood, which are lovely insights. I go into nature and do a bit of a riff on whatever nature's throwing at me living in the countryside on that particular day. But it's about the music, bringing lots of different, exciting, relaxing, soothing music to people.
Okay, so now what's your last piece then?
So my last piece, this is the double bass of Danny Thompson with Spanish flamenco, and it's called Jarabi. So joyous. So you've got Spanish flamenco, you've got Tumano Di Barte on the cori, you've got double bass with Danny Thompson. It's a lovely collection of super sounds.
Dr. Sean Williams, thank you very much.
It's been such a pleasure. Thank you for allowing me to play these lovely tracks. Thank you.